This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, good morning, and thank you. Thank you, Dr. Conte and Dr. Eichler, for inviting me here. So today, I'm basically going to talk about how the BEST trial has changed my practice, and I don't have any disclosures. USC, we've been very fortunate to have the BEST trial, and it's been very successful for us. But before going into how it's changed my practice, I figured I would say just a few things about our typical practice of patients with CLI at USC. We're pretty much a reverse saphenous vein group, and we do use alternative conduits such as the lesser saphenous and arm vein. We have not had very good success with our PTFE bypasses or cryo, no matter how much we try. It's still not a big part of our practice. We do believe in early debridement of necrotic tissue, get it off, and then try to see how much healing we have and how fast we can move that patient in and out of the hospital. And for our endo, we're all fairly endo-competent. I kind of consider myself endo-average. I'm not doing what Dr. Montero Baker did. But we basically use balloons and stents and limited use of atherectomy. Now, what about, you know, what we say what we're doing, but is it effective? So just briefly, I'll just go through some of the ways we evaluated everything that we're doing and if I even still consider doing them. Greater saphenous vein, we said, through an open harvest is basically the technique that I still use. Endoscopic vein harvest came onto the scene, and we started to institute it at our practice at USC. But we had to say, is this really the way to go? And so we looked at about 76 bypasses, some endoscopic vein harvest by one of my partners, and I was pretty much in the open arm to see if we could see if there was a difference in wound care, if there was a difference in outcomes of the bypasses, even patency. And we tried to have the patients matched fairly evenly in the two groups. If you look at some of the results, length of stay, we didn't see much of a difference at all, which was kind of surprising. I did think that the endoscopic vein harvest patients would get out sooner. The only big difference we saw was in narcotic use, with the patients with a smaller incision requiring less narcotics postoperatively. When we looked at wound complications, pretty much the same overall, no difference in wound complications and even readmission for wounds. So that was somewhat interesting for our practice. And unfortunately for the endoscopic vein harvest enthusiasts, we didn't see any difference out to 3 years in primary patency. There was a slight difference with secondary patency, but not significantly. And so at that point, we had to say, well, is this really something that we need to be doing? So we went to the VQI, our big national database, to see if we can get some numbers based on a larger patient population. And in the VQI, they basically code, when you enter the patient, you code based on whether you harvested the vein endoscopically completely, you skipped incisions like the middle right here, or whether you did a continuous incision, which I still use personally. Most of the people in the group were still doing an open harvest, with only about 13% of the patients doing endoscopic vein harvest. Surgical site infection, not much difference between the groups at all. Continuous was a little bit higher, but there was no statistical significance. But we did see, as the BMI went up, all the patients tended to have a higher likelihood of getting wound infections, which we thought was consistent, and we did believe that data. Now, this is the one that kind of shocked us. So in our study, small study, 76 patients, we didn't see any difference in patency. But here, in the larger study, significant difference at 1 year, with the endoscopic vein harvest patients having a lower patency. Wasn't statistically significant, but still made us start thinking. And so now, I'm pretty much staying with continuous open harvest, and some of my partners are coming back over as well. For inflow occlusion to do our distal bypasses, we do believe in using the tourniquet. It can be rather hard sometimes. Sometimes you're inflating up to 300 millimeters of mercury. But you basically just Esmark the leg. We still believe in this, and we still continue to do it. We don't have data to show that it's better, but it does at least provide a bloodless feel. And for your trainees, it's easier for them to sew in that type of feel and get familiar with some difficult bypasses down at the tibial level. When I got to USC, completion duplex was pretty much pushed down my throat, and I adopted it. And we continue to do it. We basically, at the end of the procedure, bring the vascular lab into the operating room and get flow dynamics of our bypass. I think it is very helpful to learn how to construct your bypass. Slight changes in angles change the flow dynamics of that bypass, and I do think that affects early restenosis of your bypass. So I think it is helpful. The question is it helpful for long-term aspect of the bypass? And so we went to, again, the Vascular Quality Initiative and looked at a lot of patients, basically 14,000 or more that had lower extremity bypasses by over 600 surgeons. And they were taken from all the regions across the United States that were involved in the Vascular Quality Initiative. And it was interesting because we just, the way it's entered there, it's basically, did you do a completion study at all? Did you do a completion angiogram? Or did you do a completion duplex? And the range was all over the map. You had here from some regions where very little duplex was done and not that many completion angiograms. This region, 92% of the surgeons did not do any type of completion imaging. And over here, you have another group that does do a lot of completion imaging, and about 51% of them are angiograms. So it was very diffuse in terms of the institution of completion imaging when surgeons perform bypasses. What was interesting, though, is if you look, when you had a very good vein, about half of the surgeons said, okay, I'll do some form of completion imaging, either duplex or angiogram. And as the type of bypass, the complexity tends to increase. So you're talking about arm vein, lesser saphenous vein, or multiple veins. The surgeon said, okay, look, I need to do more completion imaging. And they did, up to about 60%. And I think that fit. As the bypass got harder, you wanted to see whether your results were going to be adequate. Again, not much of a difference with completion imaging at 1 year in terms of patency. And so in my own practice, I've kind of slowed on it. If it's a difficult tibial, if it's something that is, again, a complex with multiple pieces of vein, I'll use it. But right now, I'm not using it as much as I used to. So the best CLI, what I'm here to talk about, it's a big multi-institutional study I think it's even more than 120 right now in both the United States and Canada. And it basically compares open surgical to endovascular and is trying to decide what is the best treatment for these patients with critical limb ischemia. For us, the trial has been remarkable. We had a lot of patients, and we've been able to enroll a lot of patients in the trial, and I'll tell you how it has changed our practice. This is basically a poster we presented at Washington, D.C. at one of the cardiology meetings to talk about the methodology of what's taken place in how we manage patients with CLI now as compared to before the trial. And one thing that's been a big part of it was cardiology. At our center, and well, first of all, in the trial, actually, I think before the trial got funded by the NIH, one of the criteria was that you had people outside of vascular surgery that were able to perform peripheral interventions, either cardiology or interventional radiology. The NIH wanted inclusion of those physicians into the trial. And so we asked our cardiologists to join, and one cardiologist in particular has been a lead in helping the success of this trial at our institution. But it's been very helpful. In fact, for now, we've combined our services at our county facility. We have a vascular medicine person on the service at all times, which is basically a fellowship of the cardiology program. And what's been beneficial is the cath lab doors have opened. So instead of me doing my interventions or bypasses on this side of the hospital and the cardiologist doing theirs at this side of the hospital, now everything, the barriers have all gone down. And so we're able to say, oh, okay, I have this over here, you have this over there. They allow our fellows to scrub with them and and really, because they're so facile at using smaller wires to do peripheral interventions and interventions in the coronaries, it's really helped our fellows develop a diffuse and technical considerations in terms of being able to handle very small wires. And the reciprocal is that the cardiologists now have an appreciation for vascular surgery. They come to our conferences and they say, look, okay, I think this patient does need a bypass as opposed to having some difficult type of intervention that we would typically do alone in the cath lab. And so we've kind of reached a point of harmony, and I'm hoping it stays that way. You know, there's always things that could happen. If they restart their peripheral fellowship, there may be some type of competition. But for right now, what we've benefited from the trial, was this harmonious relationship between cardiology and vascular at our institution. We've also formed a CLI team to help with the recruitment of patients and management of patients. And it's basically, like I said, the cardiologists, ourselves, vascular medicine, the research coordinator plays a big part, and the fellows also play a big part. We didn't have that much of organization in this prior to the trial, but it's helped us say, look, we need to start getting better organized and get things discussed for these patients instead of doing it on your own in the cath lab or in the angio suite. Some of the things we discuss, well, should limb salvage be offered? And yeah, it is pretty easy when you have these kinds of patients. One should have it, one should not. But patients like this, you know, brings up a lot of discussion as to whether we should even offer limb salvage. And you'd be surprised the discussions that take place. You don't really know what inherent biases you have until you start verbalizing them with other people in the group that have different opinions, and then it just turns into some interesting discussions. We also look at vein availability, different conduits, comorbidities, and reliability of the patient, because once these patients get discharged, you know, it is a big issue. I remember in vascular surgery, there was a lot of talk about 5 to 10 years ago, what's the benefit of doing these procedures if we're discharging patients to these long-term facilities and the patient loses their functional independence? Well, that's all fine, but in our facility, we're very close to, you know, Los Angeles, and there's a big homeless community. We're just worried about, you know, discharging the patients out here to the community. And also, discharging patients, especially with our large population, going across the border. Sometimes we can't find them. So those are things that we have to bring up early on before we institute all these procedures for limb salvage. And we had to, like I said, overcome all of our treatment biases, because you basically feel comfortable when you're just the only one treating the patients. But so you develop all these personal algorithms. But really and truly, there's very little data to say what you have developed is exactly the right thing. And so we're hoping that this trial answers some of those questions and will be able to lead us in the right direction and be able to decide which patients should be treated with each modality. The conversations do get very heated at times, and sometimes we, you know, just don't really know what to do, but for the most part, at least I'm happy just that the conversations are taking place and across disciplines. Take, for example, this patient with just a small heel ulcer. This here is his angiogram, and you can obviously see the below-knee popliteal occlusion. A lot of tibial disease throughout the anterior side. The woundosome, in Dr. Montero Baker's case, is a little ischemic out here. But this was a case where a lot of the endo enthusiasts said, how could you offer this patient a bypass? I don't think it's going to work, and this patient should obviously have endo, such a short lesion. And if you look at the area in the foot, you know, it's, again, paucity of flow out here to the posterior. For right now, this patient ended up randomizing to open. And so that created a very difficult scenario for us, because we could see we weren't going to get much in this region. And so I basically had to find somewhere in here, just chipped out some calcium and put the bypass on there as best I could. And we'll have to see what happens. But those are going to be things that the trial may not be able to discuss. And so we'll see. We'll take it from there. This patient, like I showed before, a lot of discussion as to whether his 30-day amputation rate was going to be too high to put into the trial. But we went ahead and we did. We angioed them and didn't really have a lot of tibial disease up higher. But as you get down in the mid-tibia and down near the foot, the disease got to be very extensive. Question was, okay, he randomized to open also. Where do you want to put the bypass to get the best flow down to this region? Are you going to put it way down here? Are you going to put it over here? And so these kind of discussions just take place, and it's actually been academically, I think, very productive for us. One last part that I feel has really changed our practice was the role of diagnostic angiogram. And it seemed very counterintuitive to the vascular surgeons in the group, but for the cardiologists, they were used to this. Oftentimes, they'll perform a heart catheterization, talk it over with the cath team or the surgeons, and then decide whether they're going to go for PCI or for surgery or for medical management. So for them, they were like, yeah, why not? And we said, let's stop, do the diagnostic angiogram, and then from there, randomize the patient and move forward. And it was a buy-in on both sides, and so it's been very effective. And I think that's what's really helped us increase our enrollment for the trial, because now the cardiologist will do someone in the cath lab, do a diagnostic angio, send me the photos, and then we discuss it, cross-hash, and decide whether the patient should be enrolled, and then go from there. I do think it helps with endovascular planning, especially if you're performing some of the complex procedures in the below the knee, below the ankle. Now you can come back and stick the patient antegrade and perform those procedures in a more effective manner than you would if you're just going in and you're not even sure what you're going to get what the disease is going to show in terms of after you do the angiogram. So I think it is better for planning. You are able to address the comorbidities. You do have an informed consent. And I think, again, the techniques are shared between both specialties. And you may say, well, you know, we're a busy practice. What about your length of stay? Okay, well, I can tell you how it's been, at least at USC, where, again, we're in the VQI. This was our length of stay if you look from 2011 out to 2014. We entered the trial in December 2014, and we have the data going out to 2016. So this is pretty much after the trial. And our length of stay has actually come down. So I think that's been of benefit, and I think that's also testament to the CLI team and the nurse practitioners that help. Our length of stay greater than 7 days has started to come down, as well as our use of discharge statins, so everybody's aware of what these patients need, and I feel that we're giving them better care. We're not quite to the place that we need to be, but we have improved. So additional lessons I've learned personally from the trial in closing, for me, I have to figure out, okay, where am I in this whole endo-open approach? What is my balance? Am I becoming endo-average to endo-below-average, or am I instituting endo enough, or am I too heavy on the bypass side? And so I'm constantly weighing where I am, both from a mindset as well as a technical perspective. And so it's just been a constant evaluation of myself, because when the trial ends, if one particular modality is beneficial, I don't want to be left out. I want to be able to treat the patients completely as a vascular surgeon. So I'm continuously evaluating myself. And it says also here, what other lessons have we learned? Data management. We do need a limb salvage center. I'm going to talk about that later today. And we do need to keep investigating and figuring out what's the best in our current practice. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Rowe.
Questions?
Looks like we have one from Miguel.
Sir, yep. I'm not part of the best CLI. We're not part of the best CLI, but I have a question. In a case like that you showed that you had to go for open and did this bypass, are you allowed in the event that the patient isn't really progressing because there is still maybe this regional ischemia at the wound osome? Is that patient that's been given an open bypass, can they still go and do endo into the pedal loop after the bypass, because you can use the bypass as a modality to go into the below the ankle vessels and then try to reperfuse? Are you allowed in the study to do that in the event that the patient doesn't progress with the bypass?
Yes, you are. You just have to document it. I'm not sure how they're going to categorize that in the trial as a crossover or an open failure, but yes, you are. We actually have done that, I believe, twice. once exactly for the case you're talking about in a patient that had a distal anterior tibial bypass, and they went back and opened up the DP and some of the arch. So, yes, you can. Yes.
Thanks, Dr. Rowe. Great talk. Question in regards to your limb salvage team, which may come up later in your talk later today. But
yes.
In this one, I love the harmony idea between cardiology and vascular surgery. And up in our area, we're trying to create this harmony between podiatry and vascular surgery, as David Armstrong talks about the toe and flow model. Are you guys doing something like that at USC?
Well, like I'll say later today, we are getting there. We're not quite there yet. I think we were behind. And I think this trial has exposed the fact that we were behind. And once we saw how multiple specialties can contribute to the care of these difficult patients, we're trying to get there.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.